Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Our speaker is Jose Casanova, professor of sociology at Georgetown University. Professor Casanova's lecture is titled The Secular, Secularizations, and Secularisms. We begin with an introduction by Robert Heffner, professor of anthropology and director of the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs at Boston University.
In a series of learned, interdisciplinary publications, and in his role as the president of the Association for the Sociology of Religion, Jose Casanova reinvented the field of the sociology of religion. He did so, moreover, in what was a most unusual two-pronged way. First, he got his feet dirty, very dirty, doing comparative and aerial research, working in Spain, the Ukraine, Poland, and the United States on religion and public life, and he still does that. The second prong was that he leapt into the maelstrom of high sociological theory, indeed the sociology of religion's core intellectual instrument, that is, secularization theory, and he reconstructed it in an entirely original and important way. In his masterpiece, Public Religion in the Modern World, he showed that religion in the West, and he noted in most of the rest of the world, had broken with its assumed pattern, in liberal theory in particular, of private conviction, privatization, and it had begun to go public again. He analyzed the conditions under which this religious resurgence could be compatible with democracy and modern social pluralism. Along the way, and in the years since, Casanova has authored a series of powerful works, always highly original, always very readable at the same time, on topics as varied as Islam and modernity, gender and modern religious change, and the sources of Pentecostalism's globalizing power. Casanova received his BA in philosophy from the Seminario Metropolitano in Zaragoza, Spain. Then he received an MA in theology from the University of Innsbruck, an MA in theology, and another in sociology from the New School for Social Research. He completed his PhD in sociology at the New School in 1982, and then he taught at the New School from 1987 to 2007. I think I met you about 5 years into your tenure there. Jose, it's a great pleasure to welcome you, and I hope that you would join in welcoming him today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure and a great honor. I'm going to start my lecture by giving some results from public opinion surveys in Europe, which will show how much the topic secularisms is related to the topic of toleration and freedom. Indeed, it's astounding to observe how widespread is the view throughout Europe that religion is intolerant and creates conflict. According to the 1998 ISSP, the International Social Survey Program Public Opinion Poll, the overwhelming majority of Europeans, practically over two-thirds of the population in every Western European country, held the view that religion is intolerant. This was a widespread view, moreover, already before September 11. Since people are unlikely to expressly recognize their own intolerance, one can assume that in expressing such an opinion, Europeans are thinking of somebody else's religion, or alternatively, present a selective retrospective memory of their own past religion, which fortunately they consider to have outgrown. It is even more telling that the majority of the population in every Western European country, with the significant exception of Norway and Sweden, where only 47-49%, so it was not a majority, shares the view that religion creates conflict. It should seem obvious that such a widespread negative view of religion as being intolerant and conducive to conflict can hardly be grounded empirically in the collective historical experience of European societies in the 20th century or in the actual personal experience of most contemporary Europeans. It can plausibly be explained, however, as a secular construct that has the function of positively differentiating modern secular Europeans from the religious other, either from pre-modern religious Europeans or from contemporary non-European religious people, particularly from Muslims. So when they think of religion as intolerant, obviously Europeans are not thinking of themselves, even when many of them may still be religious. But rather they must be thinking either of the religion they have left behind or of the religion of the other within their midst, which happens to be Islam. Insofar as they identify religion with intolerance, they seem to imply that they have happily left their own intolerance behind by getting rid of religion. The argument for tolerance becomes, in this sense, a justification for secularity as the source of tolerance. Most striking is the view of religion in the abstract as the source of violent conflict, given the actual historical experience of most European societies in the 20th century. The European short century from 1914 to 1989, using Eric Hobsbawm's apt characterization, was indeed one of the most violent, bloody, and genocidal centuries in the history of humanity. But none of the horrible massacres, neither the senseless slaughter of millions of young Europeans in the trenches of World War I, nor the countless millions of victims of Bolshevik and communist terror through revolution, civil war, collectivization campaigns, the Great Famine in Ukraine, the repeated cycles of Stalinist terror and the Gulag, nor the most unfathomable of all, the Nazi Holocaust and the global conflagration of World War II, culminating in the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, none of those terrible conflicts can be said to have been caused by religious fanaticism and intolerance. All of them were rather products of modern secular ideologies. Yet contemporary Europeans obviously prefer to selectively forget the more inconvenient recent memories of secular ideological conflict and retrieve instead the long forgotten memories of the religious wars of early modern Europe to make sense of the religious conflicts they see today proliferating around the world and increasingly threatening them. Rather than seeing the common structural context of modern state formation, interstate geopolitical conflicts, modern nationalism, and the political mobilization of ethnocultural and religious identities, processes central to modern European history that became globalized through the European colonial expansion, Europeans prefer seemingly to attribute these conflicts to religion, that is, to religious fundamentalism and to fanaticism and intolerance, which is supposedly intrinsic to pre-modern religion, an atavistic residue which modern, secular, enlightened Europeans have fortunately left behind. One may suspect that the function of such a selective historical memory is to safeguard the perception of the progressive achievements of Western secular modernity, offering a self-validating justification of the secular separation of religion and politics as the condition for modern liberal democratic politics, for global peace, and for the protection of individual privatized religious freedom. This is the foundational myth not only of the mother nation's secular state, but also of Western secular modernity, namely the foundational myth of the wars of religion. And I'm saying that you may want to read the fantastic book by William Cavanaugh, The Myth of Religious Violence, which basically really, really deconstructs this myth. But I came to this conclusion well before reading Cavanaugh, when about several years ago I was invited to the trilogue. The trilogue at the Salzburg Festival, a very festive occasion, where they try to help Middle Easterners, Jews, Muslims, and Christians who cannot live together in the Middle East. And I heard the same story of the foundational myth repeated again and again by the foreign minister of Germany, Joschka Fischer, by the foreign minister of Austria, I don't remember her name, by the head of the Salzburg Festival, and by the head of the Bertelsmann Foundation, the big German foundation that was sponsoring the trilogue. And the story went like that. We Europeans, once upon a time, also didn't know how to live together. We also had fused religion and politics. The consequence was the terrible religious wars of early modernity. But happily, because of this catastrophe, we learned to separate religion and politics, and look at us now. Please, if you Middle Easterners would learn from us, you would know how to live together. You bring secular liberal democracy, and this is the solution to the problem of religion. So the notion that secularism and the secular state is the solution to the problem of religion is the foundational myth of secular modernity. Of course, there is a myth in the dual sense that our categories are so shaped by this myth that we cannot think otherwise, first. But it's a myth because history is not like that. We know that out of the Peace of Westphalia, didn't come the secular state. What came was the confessional territorial state that confessionalized religions, territorialized religions and peoples, and what the result was not religious tolerance. It was ethno-religious cleansing. Cuius regio, eius religio. The notion that the religion of the ruler becomes the religion of the subjects. And if it doesn't happen to be your religion, tough. You have the right to emigrate. It was not religious freedom. It was not religious toleration that came out of the Westphalian peace. It was simply the right to emigrate. And in this respect, the process has been repeated again and again whenever the mother nation state has been established beyond Europe. The Ottoman Empire falls apart. Every time in the Middle East, in the Balkans, it repeats the story. In India, when the British Empire falls apart, everywhere the nation state emerges, you have basically a repetition of the so-called religious wars of early modernity. The question is whether it is religion which is the problem and the secular state the solution to the problem, or it has to do something with the very process of formation of the globalization of the mother nation state. But so let me then try to introduce some analytical distinctions, basic distinctions between these three categories, the secular, secularizations, secularisms. So let me introduce the basic analytical distinction between the secular as a modern epistemic, as a central modern epistemic category, secularization as an analytical conceptualization of modern world historical processes, and secularism as a worldview and ideology. All three concepts are obviously related, but are used very differently in various academic, disciplinary, and sociopolitical and cultural contexts. I propose to differentiate the three concepts simply as a way of distinguishing analytically, in an exploratory manner, between three different phenomena without any attempt to reify them as separate realities. So first, the secular. The secular is often assumed to be simply the other of the religious, that which is non-religious. In this respect, it functions simply as a residual category. But paradoxically, in our modern secular age, in our modern secular world, the secular has come to encompass increasingly the whole of reality, in a sense, replacing the religious. Consequently, the secular has come to be increasingly perceived as a natural reality devoid of religion, as the natural social and anthropological substratum that remains when the religious is lifted or disappears. This is the conception or epistemic attitude which Charles Taylor has critically characterized as subtraction theories. The paradox resides in the fact that rather than being a residual category, as was originally the case, the secular appears now as reality per se, while the religious is increasingly perceived not only as the residual category, the other of the secular, but as a superstructural and superfluous additive which both humans and societies can do without. Theories of secularization have emerged as explanatory conceptions of this process of differentiation and liberation of the secular from the religious, understood as a universal world historical process. While secularist worldviews function as justificatory explanations of the paradoxical inversion in the dyadic relation of the religious and the secular, vindicating not only the primacy of the secular over the religious, but the superseding of the religious by the secular. Both function as uncritical and unreflective ideologies, insofar as they disregard, indeed mask, the particular and contingent historicity of the process, projecting it unto the level of universal human development. Moreover, by postulating the secular as the natural and universal substratum which emerges once the superstructural religious addition is lifted, theories of secularization, as well as secularist social science, have avoided the task of analyzing, studying, and explaining the secular, the varieties of secular experience, as if it is only the religious, but not the secular, which is in need of interpretation and analytical explanation. Indeed, what is the secular? Do we know? Does anybody know what is the secular? Well, the other of the religious. And what is the religious? The other of the secular. You cannot define the secular without the religious, and you cannot define the religious without the secular. But what is each of them? So let me introduce an analytical distinction between three different meanings of the word secular, or three different ways in which one may be said to be secular, to which will correspond three different understandings of the process of secularization. So first, mere secularity, simple secularity, living in the secular world and in secular time. This is the broadest possible sense of the term secular, which is derived from the medieval Christian theological transformation of the Latin term seculum. Originally, the Latin word seculum, as in per secula seculorum, only meant an indefinite period of time. But as first used by Augustine, the secular referred to a temporal space between the present and the eschatological parousia, the second coming of Christ, in which both Christians and pagans could come together to pursue their common interests in a civil, as a civil community. In this respect, the Augustinian use of secular is very similar to the mother meaning of a secular political sphere, that of the constitutional democratic state, and that of a democratic public sphere, which is neutral with respect to all worldviews, religious as well as non-religious. Such a conception does not equate the secular with the profane as the other of the sacred, nor is the secular the other of the religious. It is precisely a neutral space that can be shared by all who live in a non-religiously homogeneous or in a multicultural society, which by definition will have different and most likely competing conceptions of what is sacred and what is profane. This was precisely the situation in late antiquity. Judeo-Christian monotheism had led to a desacralization or disenchantment of the pagan sacred. Consequently, the Christians' refusal to sacrifice to pagan gods or to worship the divine emperor earned them the epithet of atheist. The Christian sacred was the pagan profane and vice versa. Eventually, however, with the consolidation of Western medieval Christendom and the hegemonic triumph of the Christian Church, the secular became one of the terms of a dyad, religious secular, which serves to structure the entire spatial and temporal reality of medieval Christendom into a binary system of classification separating two worlds, the religious, spiritual, sacred world of salvation, and the secular, temporal, profane world. The sacred profane and the religious secular binary systems of classification became superimposed, and the secular became now equated with the earthly city, while the religious became equated with the heavenly city. Thus, the distinction between the religious or regular clergy, who withdrew from the world into the monasteries to lead a life of Christian perfection, and the secular clergy, who live in the world along with the laity. It is from this theological perspective of medieval Christendom that the modern meaning of secularization emerges. To secularize means, first of all, to make worldly, to convert religious persons or things into secular ones, as when a religious person abandons the monastic rule to live in the world, or when monastic property is secularized. This is the medieval Christian theological meaning of the term secularization that may serve, however, as the basic metaphor of the historical process of Western secularization. This historical process needs to be understood as a particular reaction to the structure and dualism of medieval Christendom, as an attempt to bridge, eliminate, or transcend the dualism between the religious and the secular world. Even in the West, however, this process of secularization follows two different dynamics. One is the dynamic of internal Christian secularization, which aims to spiritualize the temporal and to bring the religious life of perfection out of the monasteries into the secular world. It tends to transcend the dualism by blurring the boundaries between the religious and the secular, by making the religious secular and the secular religious through mutual reciprocal infusion. This path was initiated by the various medieval movements of Christian reform of the seculum, was radicalized by the Protestant Reformation, and has attained its paradigmatic expression in the Anglo-Saxon Calvinist cultural area, particularly here in the United States. The other different, indeed almost opposite, dynamic of secularization takes the form of laicization. It aims to emancipate all secular spheres from clerical ecclesiastical control, and in this respect is marked by laic clerical antagonism. Unlike in the Protestant path, however, here the boundaries between the religious and the secular are rigidly maintained, but those boundaries are pushed into the margins, aiming to contain, privatize, and marginalize everything religious while excluding it from any visible presence in the secular public sphere, now defined as the realm of laïcité, freed from religion. With many variations, these are the two main dynamics of secularization which culminate in our secular age. In different ways, both paths lead to an overcoming of the medieval Christian dualism through a positive affirmation and revaluation of the seculum, that is, of the secular age and the secular world, imbuing the immanent secular world with a quasi-transcendent meaning as the place for human flourishing. So this is the first meaning, simply living in the secular world, in the secular age. There is a second meaning, which is what I call self-contained secularity within the immanent frame of the secular age. But then the question is to be or not to be religious. That is the question. This constitutes one possible end result of the process of secularization, of the attempt to overcome the dualism between the religious and the secular by freeing oneself of the religious component. In his recent work, A Secular Age, Charles Taylor has reconstructed the process through which the phenomenological experience of what he calls the immanent frame becomes constituted as an interlocking constellation of the modern differentiated cosmic, social, and moral orders. All three orders, the cosmic, the social, and the moral, are understood as purely immanent secular orders, devoid of transcendence, and thus functioning etsi deus non daretur, as if God would not exist. It is this phenomenological experience that, according to Taylor, constitutes our age paradigmatically as a secular one, irrespective of the extent to which people living in this age may still hold religious or atheistic beliefs. The question is whether the phenomenological experience of living within such an immanent frame is such that people within it will also tend to function etsi deus non daretur. Taylor is inclined to answer this question in the affirmative. Indeed, his phenomenological account of the secular conditions of belief is meant to explain the change from a Christian society around 1500, in which belief in God was unchallenged and unproblematic, indeed naive and taken for granted, to a post-Christian society today, in which belief in God not only is no longer axiomatic, but becomes increasingly problematic. So that even those who adopt and engage a standpoint as believers tend to experience reflexively their own beliefs as an option among many others, one moreover requiring explicit justification. Secularity, being without religion by contrast, tends to become increasingly the default option, which can be naively experienced as natural and thus no longer in need of justification. This naturalization of unbelief or irreligiosity as the normal modern human condition is a characterization which certainly applies to a majority of Western European societies. But it is not characteristic of the United States, where being religious is still the normal default option, while unbelief is the uncommon option which requires a reflexive commitment and is in need of justification. But indeed, the fact that there are some modern non-European societies, such as the United States or South Korea, that are fully secular in the sense that they function within the same immanent frame, and yet their populations are also at the same time conspicuously religious, or the fact that the modernization of so many non-Western societies is accompanied by process of religious revival, should put into question the premise that the decline of religious beliefs and practices is a quasi-natural consequence of process of modernization. If modernization per se does not produce necessarily the progressive decline of religious beliefs and practice, then we need a better explanation for the radical and widespread secularity one finds among the population of Western European societies. And there is a third form of secularity, what I call secularist secularity, and secularism as a stadial consciousness. I would like to maintain that secularization in the sense of being devoid of religion does not happen automatically as a result of process of modernization, but it needs to be mediated phenomenologically by some other particular historical experience. Self-sufficient secularity, that is, the absence of religion, has a better chance of becoming the normal taken-for-granted position if it is experienced not simply as an unreflexively naive condition, as just a fact, but actually as the meaningful result of a quasi-natural process of development. As Taylor has pointed out, modern unbelief is not simply a condition of absence of belief, nor merely indifference. It is a historical condition that requires the perfect tense, a condition of having overcome the irrationality of belief. Intrinsic to this phenomenological experience is a modern stadial consciousness of having gone through stages of development inherited from the Enlightenment, which understands this anthropocentric change in the conditions of belief as a process of maturation and growth, as a coming of age, and as progressive emancipation. For Taylor, this stadial phenomenological experience serves in turn to ground the phenomenological experience of exclusive humanism as the positive, self-sufficient, and self-limiting affirmation of human flourishing, and as the critical rejection of transcendence beyond human flourishing as self-denial and self-defeating. In this respect, the historical self-understanding of secularism has the function of confirming the superiority of our present modern secular outlook over other supposedly earlier and therefore more primitive religious forms of understanding. To be secular means to be modern, and therefore by implication, to be religious means to be somehow not yet fully modern. This is the ratchet effect of a modern historical stadial consciousness which turns the very idea of going back to a surpassed condition into an unthinkable intellectual regression. The function of secularism as a philosophy of history and thus as ideology is to turn the particular Western Christian historical process of secularization into a universal teleological process of human development from belief to unbelief, from primitive irrational or metaphysical religion to modern, rational, post-metaphysical, secular consciousness. Even when the particular role of internal Christian developments in the general process of secularization is acknowledged, it is not in order to stress the particular contingent nature of the process, but rather to stress the universal significance of the uniqueness of Christianity, as in Marcel Gauchet's expressive formulation, the religion to exit from religion. I would like to propose that this secularist stadial consciousness is a crucial factor in the widespread secularization that has accompanied the modernization of Western European societies. Europeans tend to experience their own secularization, that is, the widespread decline of religious beliefs and practice among their midst, as a natural consequence of their modernization. In this respect, the theory of secularization, mediated through this historical estadial consciousness, tends to function as a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is, in my view, the presence or absence of this secularist historical estadial consciousness that explains when and where processes of modernization are accompanied by radical secularization. In places where such secularist historical estadial consciousness is absent or less dominant, as in the United States, or in most non-Western post-colonial societies, processes of modernization are unlikely to be accompanied by process of religious decline. On the contrary, they may be accompanied by process of religious revival. So briefly, secularizations. In the book Public Religions in the Modern World, which Bob has mentioned, I propose to disaggregate analytically what was usually taken to be one single theory of secularization into three disparate and not necessarily interrelated components or subthesis, namely the theory of the institutional differentiation of the so-called secular spheres, such as the state, economy, and science, from religious institutions and norms. Second, the theory of the progressive decline of religious beliefs and practices as a concomitant of levels of modernization. And third, the theory of privatization of religion as a precondition of modern secular and democratic politics. Such an analytical distinction makes possible the testing of each of these three subtheses separately as different, empirically falsifiable propositions. Any thinking of secularization beyond the West has to begin with the recognition of a dual historical paradox, namely that the secular emerges first as a particular Western Christian theological category, while its modern antonym, the religious, is a product of Western secular modernity. The contextualization of our categories, religious and secular, should begin, therefore, with the recognition of the particular Christian historicity of Western European developments, as well as of the multiple and diverse historical patterns of differentiation and fusion of the religious and the secular, as well as of their mutual constitution within European and Western societies. Such a recognition, in turn, should allow a less Eurocentric comparative analysis of patterns of differentiation and secularization in other civilizations and world religions, and more importantly, the further recognition that the world historical process of globalization initiated by European colonial expansion, all these processes everywhere are dynamically interrelated and mutually constituted. Indeed, any discussion of secularization as a global process should start with a reflexive observation that one of the most important global trends is the globalization of the category of religion itself and of the binary classification of reality, religious-secular, which it entails. While the social sciences, certainly my discipline, the sociology of religion, still function with a relatively unreflexive general category of religion, within the newer discipline of religious studies, the very category of religion has undergone numerous challenges as well as all kinds of critical deconstructions, to the point that some of the most important scholars within the discipline of religious studies have advocated to get rid of the category altogether because it doesn't mean anything. Ironically, scholars of religion are questioning the validity of the category of religion at the very same moment when the discursive reality of religion is more widespread than ever and has become for the first time global. I'm not claiming that people today everywhere are either more or less religious than they may have been in the past. Here I am bracketing out altogether the question which has dominated most theories of secularization, namely whether religious beliefs and practices are declining or growing as a general modern trend throughout the world. I'm only claiming that religion as a discursive reality, indeed as an abstract category, and a system of classification of reality used by modern individuals as well as by modern societies across the world, by religious as well as by secular authorities, has become an indisputable global social fact. It is obvious that when people around the world use the same category of religion, they actually mean very different things. The actual concrete meaning of whatever people denominate as religion can only be elucidated in the context of their particular discursive practices. But the very fact that the same category of religion is being used globally across cultures and civilizations testifies to the global expansion of the modern secular religious system of classification of reality, which first emerged in the modern Christian West. Moreover, while the religious secular system of classification of reality may have become globalized, what remains hardly disputed and debated almost everywhere in the world today is how, where, and by whom the proper boundaries between the religious and the secular ought to be drawn. There are, in this respect, multiple competing secularisms, as there are multiple and diverse forms of religious fundamentalist resistance to those secularisms. For example, American, French, Turkish, Indian, and Chinese secularisms, and we could add Indonesian, Senegalese, etc., to name only some paradigmatic and distinctive modes of drawing the boundaries between the religious and the secular, represent not only very different patterns of separation of secular state and religion, but very different models of state regulation and management of religion and of religious pluralism in society. We should think of process of secularization, of religious transformations and revivals, and process of sacralization as ongoing, mutually constituted global processes rather than as mutually exclusive developments. Indeed, adopting a necessarily, of course, fictitious global point of view, one can observe three different parallel yet interrelated global processes which are in tension and often come in open conflict with one another. There is firstly a global process of secularization which can best be characterized as the global expansion of what Taylor has called the secular immanent frame. This frame is constituted, as I said, by the structural interlocking constellation of the modern cosmic, social, and moral secular orders. But as the ongoing debates between the European and American paradigms and the discourse of American and European exceptionalisms make clear, this process of secularization within the very same immanent frame may entail very different religious dynamics. Despite its many variations, the general European pattern is one of secularization and religious decline. But the American pattern is one of secularization combined with religious growth and recurrent religious revivals. Thus, the fundamental question for any theory of secularization is how is one to account sociologically for the radical bifurcation in the religious situation today between Western societies on both sides of the North Atlantic, that is, between the radical secularity of European societies, which indeed appear to match perfectly Taylor's phenomenological account of a secular age, and the predominant condition of religious belief among the immense majority of the American population. I concur with Dipesh Chakravarti, the Indian scholar, the need to provincialize Europe and to turn the European theories of American exceptionalism upside down. Instead of being the norm, the historical process of secularization of European Latin Christendom is the only truly exceptional process, which is unlikely to be reproduced anywhere else in the world with a similar sequential arrangement and with a corresponding stadial consciousness. Moreover, non-Western and non-Christian societies, which did not undergo a similar process of historical development, and always confronted Western secular modernity from its first encounter with European Christian colonialism, as the other, are more likely to recognize the European process of secularization for what it truly was, namely a particular Christian and post-Christian historical process, and not, as Europeans like to think, a general or universal process of human societal development. But the modern secular is by no means synonymous with the profane, nor is the religious synonymous with the modern sacred. Only the social as religious is synonymous with the sacred in Durkheimian terms. In this respect, modern secularization entails a certain profanation of religion through its privatization and individualization, and a certain sacralization of the secular spheres of politics, sacred nation, sacred citizenship, sacred constitution, of the sphere of science, temples of knowledge, and of the sphere of economics through commodity fetishism. But the truly modern sacralization, which is becoming the global civil religion in Durkheim's terms, is the cult of the individual and the sacralization of humanity through the globalization of human rights. It is an open empirical question, which should be the central focus of a comparative historical sociology of religion, how these three ongoing processes, global process of secularization, sacralization, and religious denominationalism, are mutually interrelated in different civilizations and different societies, sometimes symbiotically, as in the fusions of religious nationalisms or in the religious defense of human rights, but often antagonistically, as in the violent conflicts between the sacred, secular, immanent norms of individual life and freedom and transcendent theistic norms. What we are repeatedly observing in the local media of the global public sphere can best be understood not so much as clashes between the religious and the secular, but rather as violent confrontations over the sacred, over blasphemous and sacrilegious acts and speeches, and over the profanation of religious and secular taboos. It is all part and parcel of ongoing global struggles over universal, particular, mutual human recognition. And finally, briefly, on secularism. It may be fruitful to begin by drawing an analytical distinction between secularism as a statecraft doctrine and secularism as ideology. By secularism as a statecraft principle, I understand simply some principle of separation between religious and political authority, either for the sake of the neutrality of the state vis-à-vis each and all religions, or for the sake of protecting the freedom of conscience of each individual, or for the sake of facilitating the equal access of all citizens, religious as well as non-religious, to democratic participation. Such a statecraft doctrine neither presupposes nor needs to entail any substantive theory, positive or negative, of religion. Indeed, the moment the state holds explicitly a particular conception of religion, one enters the realm of ideology. One could argue that secularism becomes an ideology the moment it entails a theory of what religion is or does. It is this assumption that religion in the abstract is a transhistorical and transcultural thing that has an essence and a historical development and that produces certain particular and predictable effects, which is the defining characteristic of modern secularism. One can distinguish two basic types of secularist ideologies. The first type are secularist theories of religion grounded in some progressive stadial philosophies of history, which relegates religion to a superseded state. The second type are secularist political theories, which presuppose that religion is either an irrational force or an unrational form of discourse which should be banished from the democratic public sphere. They can be called respectively philosophical-historical and political secularisms. It is the taken-for-granted identification of being modern and being secular that distinguishes most of Western Europe from the United States. In Europe, to be secular means to leave religion behind, to emancipate oneself from religion, overcoming the non-rational forms of being, thinking, and feeling associated with religion. It also means growing up, becoming mature, becoming autonomous, thinking and acting on one's own. It is precisely this assumption that secular people think and act on their own and are rational autonomous free agents, while religious people somehow are unfree, heteronomous, non-rational agents, which constitutes the foundational premise of secularist ideology. Political secularism per se, the second form, does not need to share the same negative assumptions about religion, nor assume any progressive historical development which will make religion increasingly relevant. It is actually compatible with a positive view of religion as a moral good, as an ethical communitarian reservoir of human solidarity, and as a republican virtue. But political secularism would like to contain religion within its own differentiated religious sphere and would like to maintain a secular public democratic sphere free from religion. This is the basic premise behind any form of secularism as a statecraft doctrine: the need to maintain some kind of separation between church and state, or between religious and political authorities, or between the religious and the political sphere. We should focus less on secularism as an allegedly prescriptive democratic norm, or as a functionalist requirement of modern differentiated societies, and more on the critical comparative historical analysis of the different types of secularism which have emerged in the process of modern state formation. As a statecraft doctrine, every form of secularism entails two principles which are well captured by the dual clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, namely the principle of separation, the no establishment clause, and the principle of state regulation of religion in society, the free exercise clause. It is the relationship between the two principles that determines the particular form of secularism and its affinity with democracy. Concerning the first principle, there are all kinds of degrees of separation between the two extremes of hostile and friendly separation and no separation at all. As Ahmed Kourou has shown, the type of separation at the formative period of the modern state will be very much determined by the particular configuration of relations between religious and political authorities during the ancient regime. Postcolonial states are likely to have their own particular dynamics. In colonial America, for instance, there was no national church across the 13 colonies from which the new federal state needed to separate itself. So the separation was friendly, however, not only because there was no need to have a hostile separation from a non-existent established church, but more importantly, because the separation was constituted in order to protect the free exercise of religion, particularly as promoted by the sects. That is, in order to construct the conditions of possibility for religious pluralism in society. Ultimately, the question is whether secularism is an end in itself, an ultimate value, or rather a means to some other end, be it democracy, an equal citizenship, or religious and normative pluralism. Indeed, if the secularist principle of separation is not an end in itself, then it will be constructed in such a way that it maximizes the equal participation of all citizens in democratic politics and the free exercise of religion in society. Taking the two clauses together, one can construct general gradual typologies of hostile-friendly separation on the one hand, and models of free and unfree state regulation of religion in society on the other. One could advance the proposition that it is the free exercise of religion clause rather than no establishment clause which appears to be a necessary condition for democracy. One cannot have democracy without freedom of religion. Indeed, free exercise stands out as a normative democratic principle in itself. Since, on the other hand, there are many historical examples of secular states which were non-democratic, the Soviet-type regimes, Kemalist Turkey, or post-revolutionary Mexico being obvious cases, one can therefore conclude that the strict secular separation of church and state is neither a sufficient nor a necessary condition for democracy. The no-establishment principle appears defensible and necessary primarily as a means to free exercise and to equal rights. Understandably, most discussions of secular and secularism are internal Western Christian secular debates about patterns of Christian Western secularization. As Noah Feldman, who will also be in this lecture series, has pointed out, this is basically a debate as how we got from St. Augustine to where we are today. We should be cautious in trying to elevate this particular and contingent historical process to some general universal historical model. Indeed, we should remind ourselves that the secular emerged first as a particular Western Christian theological category, a category which did not only serve to organize the particular social formation of Western Christendom, but very much structured thereafter the very dynamics of how to transform or free oneself from such a system. Eventually, however, as a result of this particular historical process of secularization, the secular has become the dominant category that serves to structure and delimit legally, philosophically, scientifically, and politically the nature and the boundaries of religion. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Georgetown University professor Jose Casanova titled The Secular, Secularizations, and Secularisms. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Our speaker was introduced by Robert Heffner, professor of anthropology and director of the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.